Welcome to the Fuller Money Audio Commentary. This is David Fuller on Thursday, March 11th, recording at 5:24 p.m. British Standard Time. A more sensible hour, as you will note after all my nocturnal goings on. But let's get on with matters here. I am going to talk about supply inelasticity again, but first let me give a quick view of these global markets to kick off. First, a correction was already underway. It followed that rise that we saw in the S&P, the 50% gain from the October 2002 low, and then the rally became a year old. And these are certainly more than reason enough for a pause for reflection, as they say. We had that strong run that commenced, additional run, I should say, that commenced in December and carried many stock markets on upwards right into January, February, and some of them even into the beginning of March. So we were overbought in the short term. We'd reached those milestones for the U.S. S&P. And then we had Warren Buffett come out and say he couldn't see any value anywhere in the marketplace. Then we had, actually before that, we had the dollar commence its technical rally. And that sort of unsettled people, nerves jittering. I mean, it's not by any means all bad, but the thing about markets and the thing about market psychology that's so fascinating is that people get used to what's going on and they extrapolate what's going on, and the universe seems orderly, and if it seems orderly, then it seems predictable. And then there's a disruption. And the dollar was the sort of little mini supernova there that sort of unsettled people, and it convulsed a few markets. And then people say, well, my goodness, if that can happen on something that was seemed as sure a bet, I put that sure a bet in inverted commas here, and you remember other comments about that. Whenever you get a consensus it's as strong as that, that the dollar can only go down, that the euro is going, it's only a matter of time before it gets to 135 and so on. When you get everybody saying the same thing, it reflects what they've already done, and it's a contrary indicator, and so on. So you had all these factors, this conjunction of factors here, which have tipped this market over into a correction. And then we've had people, very good analysts, people like Chris Roberts, who've been saying, look, we're going to get a correction, and it'll start here, and so on. So that has taken place. Now, my gut hunch is, you saw my long discussion there yesterday on the website, perhaps with a composite client, and in other words, it was basically a debate with myself put together on comments that I've been receiving and things that I've been seeing and reading, and so on. And it raises the question, have markets, stock markets, actually seen their very best? Well, they could have, as I said, but I'll stick my neck out and say probably not. Probably not. Now, what about today's action? I mean, I've had journalists from Slovenia and Moscow and all over the place coming in. I've taken the phone off the hook for the last couple of hours because I've got to go to the opera tonight to see Simon Boccanegra, and so I need to get this copy out and have a little bit of a break away from the office. But something like that terrible atrocity in Spain, that just adds to the bearish sentiment. But as I said to these journalists, the market was already falling beforehand. This just gave it an additional nudge on the downside, and in so doing helps to get markets a bit more oversold, those that are already oversold in the short term. But you know what they need? They need upward dynamics to check that decline. So Asia was soft. Hong Kong and Japan both down just under 1.25 for the Nikkei, and 144 for Hong Kong, which is back now to an area of a sort of little bit of psychological support from that, that February low, 1300. There's a lot on that on the website. not all of those Asian markets were soft. Interestingly, the Thai market was a little bit steadier. So this does not yet look like, as I say, the big one in terms of a downdraft that's going to just run all the way back to the S&P lows, which I do think is going to eventually happen. As you know, this looks to me like another one of these somewhat bigger softening up corrections. It's late stage activity in a market cycle where we've seen the best gains overall. The values aren't the same. I mean, who could deny, who could disagree with what Buffett has said on this? Therefore, markets are nervous, and that's going to remain the case, but I don't see sufficient catalysts other than sand running through the hourglass here to and apprehension about 2005, and with good reason, but that's still a long way down the road. And bottom line, these short-term interest rates are not pushing up rapidly, and we still have this credit creation game going on, and to the extent to which people were seeing the dollar's weakness as a possible crisis, there's been a pause in that, and so on. Now, therefore, I think that we may well see markets experience a medium-term correction that runs for 2-3 months, probably a little bit more, and then push a bit higher. But I think we need to watch the leaders for that recovery, and I'd be watching markets like Thailand, and I want to be watching the NASDAQ, but we'll be talking about this. I'll be talking about this every single day, as you know. Elsewhere, Europe, big hits right across the board. The biggest of the big, DAX down 3.46%, although that's still trading, and declines of close to 3% pretty well everywhere else. So very big hits. A little bit of acceleration, but some of those had seen minimal weakness prior to today, including the UK FTSE 100 index. Now, Wall Street opens soft. It's picked up. The NASDAQ is up 11, and the Dow's unchanged. The S&P's down 1 as I speak. I may come back to that if time allowing. Now, elsewhere, in the currencies, we had the euro weakened down to 121.64. It's very much range-bound at this stage, but now it's picked up again in here. It is at 122.78 against the dollar. So that's a bit steady. And in terms of other currency activity, not a great deal going on here, but the bottom line is that the dollar is a little bit softer in here today. Now, when that happens, that really does firm up the metals, as you know, and we're seeing that not a lot of action in gold. It's back at 400, all virtually unchanged on the day, having been down to 397.20. Palladium, where I've got that a big speculative position of mine, is at 274. It has been as high as 276. I've got a delayed feed on that, incidentally, half an hour. And the low on the palladium is 265. So it's been holding up very, very steadily in here right now. Now, Chris Roberts has put out that bearish comment on copper, and you know that copper has this little top in here, but once this dollar starts to soften a little bit, it certainly doesn't stay down for long, and it's not in here right now. So looking at this, I can actually see. Sorry, telephone was ringing, so I'm just taking it off the hook again. That'll infuriate someone. Copper's up 4 cents here today, 4.15 at 132.90 now on the May contract. So that's bounced back. And if I put up my metals page, which is up right now, beg your pardon, it is not. Isn't this terrible when I get these pauses here? I feel I get so embarrassed. On the audience, but metals, Now, Tin, I've really got to do something about it. I've been procrastinating here and making excuses about running around and spending too much time, too many long hours on the website and meetings about the website and the next stage of the website. But it's my own fault here. But Tin, I've said that's the one that's showing the relative strength in here, and it's up $110 today as I speak. This is another new high, 7160. This is very orderly on the charts. I've already given you the copper price and the palladium price. Palladium, incidentally, I'm switching back and forth between the precious and the non-ferrous, but the palladium is impressive in here today, partly because platinum is down $15.50 today at 906 on the April contract, and usually that's a drag on palladium. If platinum is soft, but palladium seems to be coming into its own in terms of recognition of value relative to the others. And you know, there's fundamental analysts have all been talking about the supply problem in here, but I've been looking at metal cycles since 1970, and I've never ever seen a major low bottom area in metal markets where people weren't talking about the tremendous overhanging supply. Well, that's how markets got down to those lows. Now, looking again at these metals, the only one that's lagging in here is nickel. I think possibly my hand had been stayed as far as the going back into the tin by not wanting to move in. I'd lost the commonality. You know, I'd mentioned that to when they were all moving in the same direction together. That's great. Then I like the trends much more. Things are a bit choppy. There's the dollar issue. And so I purposely decided, you know, I'm going to miss opportunities rather than go in and do something foolish, as Warren Buffett should say. So I don't mind sitting on the sidelines here. I just don't see it. I'm not going to try to catch every single move in the markets, although I'd like to see them coming. And that brings me to the big theme here that I did want to mention again. This is my big theme just going forward for pretty much, well, the recent months and very much this year, and that is supply inelasticity. Because the most important thing, if I could just summarize the whole global investment scene, is that we're getting this massive credit creation, and central banks are just pumping and pumping and pumping money in the system to create growth. And this started with the Fed and the Bank of Japan, and they have printed more money largely through the credit creation than I feel at any other time in their history, certainly in absolute terms, if not proportionately. And of course, we've got this incredibly stimulative monetary policy in China, and that's because, of course, China, pegging the yuan to the US dollar, has the same monetary policy as the US has. And then we get these other central banks complaining because their currencies are too strong, trying to talk their currencies down. Well, at the end of the day, if they can't jawbone it down indefinitely, and they can't jawbone them down indefinitely, they've got to either cut interest rates and or increase the supply. And increasing the supply is of the currency is the big one in terms of actually lowering it. Now, that does mean, of course, that we've got all this money sloshing around in the system, and it can create periods where we get all markets moving up together. And that is very, very usual, believe you me. I think the veterans among you will know that. It is extraordinarily unusual to get bond prices moving up, stock markets moving up, commodity prices moving up, all these things going up together in this big sort of asset reflation game. And it won't always last. But my theme, again, coming back to supply and elasticity, that the best way to play these credit creation bubble environments is with markets where there is the supply and elasticity. Now, you could think of things I've mentioned before, like art, good art, commercial art. And I've been active in that field pretty much all my adult life in building up collections and then often selling them on because either I my interests are changing, or I found that the supply shortage, the biggest one of those that I actually did, I think I started buying 19th century English watercolors, mostly watercolors in the mid 1970s, and continued right on doing that until well into the mid to late 1990s. But then the collection was huge, and I moved out of my West End office, which housed a lot of them, and the home was chock-a-block with these things. And so, but I had started doing that, and get away from the story here, the reason for this, not just to tell you about my hobbies, but the inflation in the 1970s. So inelastic supply, well, they're not going to produce any more 19th century watercolors, are they? And I happen to like them. If you collect art, you better collect things that you absolutely love. And people said, oh, no yield, no yield. But of course, there's the big yield to the spirit, which I always got. But at the end of the day, where was I going to store all these things? Preserving them was an immense burden, and I didn't mind the insurance as an ongoing cost, but preservation, preventing them from fading and so on, that was always a major concern. And the supply was starting to dry up, and so I was feeling increasingly competitive at auctions, and I thought, this is not what it's all about. The artists would be appalled. And so, right, I'm going to let them all go, and I auctioned them all off in something called the Fuller Collection in 2000, April 2000, just held at Christie's in London. And then move on, and now I only collect works by living artists. But I digress too much, but that's an obvious example of supply inelasticity, although not so much inelasticity in terms of living artists. But I still have a number of paintings by deceased artists of the 20th century. Now, and I would wager that those will appreciate more than stock markets over the next 10 years because of the supply inelasticity. Houses, to a certain extent, but you can always build more houses, but not in specific locations, so that will have an appeal. But one doesn't need to love and know these fields. I'm not interested in property beyond the property that I live in. I don't want the responsibility of having another property. I don't want the vulnerability. I don't want the capital tied up in there. I don't want to have to worry about break-ins and theft. I don't want the upkeep. Call me curmudgeonly, I don't want to let it out and have other people living in my property. I don't care how brilliant an investment it is, it doesn't suit me. There are other things that suit me more, and yet I have loads of friends and subscribers who just are experts in property and know all about it and do incredibly well in that. So you have to play to your strengths, but you can see my main theme, the supply inelasticity that does apply to them, to property in some instances as well, relative to stocks. Problem for stocks going forward is that, take the Asian markets, and I love the Asian markets in terms of their long-term potential, but the banks are just queuing up with new flotations for this sort of major supply. And anytime you get a major rally in stock markets, new supply starts to come on stream. The biggest exception, to the extent that it was an exception, was in the late 1990s when share buybacks were all the mania because CEOs were trying to bump up the share price so that they could get more money for their options. And that game is certainly over and has been widely discredited, and a very, very good thing too. Metals appeal to me. If I'm going to speculate or have leveraged positions, since everything's a speculation, isn't it? But if I'm going to have leveraged positions, then I want something like the metals, and that's gold, of course. But we don't have the supply inelasticity for gold that we do with some of the other metals. For instance, European central banks have just signed a new agreement, increasing the tonnage of gold that they're going to sell over the next 5 years, mostly Germany selling, but they increased the tonnage by 25%. Well, just that is an increase in supply that will be coming onto the market. I think gold will do terribly well over the next 10 to 15 years relative to most other asset classes, and certainly shares and bonds. But I should say stock market indices and bonds. But I maintain that gold will underperform virtually every other metal going. And some of the ones that will do best are where the genuine shortages occur, and then we see that in backwardations. I would wager that all of the other metals, let's say, will outperform gold. Okay, enough on this supply inelasticity theme, and right now I'm underweight in the metals and may well increase my positions, but I won't do so aggressively. And of course, I do have that big play in palladium, which is at 276 now, as I look at the screen. Charts. I'm going to have just very quickly look at a few of these charts on the website. I should have mentioned that at the beginning. Now, if you want to bring up the website, we can run through a few of these. I'm going to look at that weekly of the Hong Kong Hang Seng Index. I did describe that. It's a little hard to see on this chart. I'm just blowing it up, but there is, last week we did have a weekly, key weekly reversal to bearish signal there. But I'm going to go back to the previous item, yesterday's item, because you remember I was, if you listen to the review, I was going to do a chart review, but we had a gremlin in the FTP system for uploading, which has subsequently been sorted out. Was sorted out late last night. So I'm just going through these charts from Wednesday, and I'm looking at the Palladium weekly. Looks like to me like it's completed the first step above the base. On the Palladium daily, that's not going to show us all that much more, but you see just this ranging upward trend that's still in play, and we've just completed, as I said, another upside breakout. Now, if you don't, or if you're not interested in this very, very quick sprint through a few charts, I've finished the audio in terms of the content items that I've got for you. Except I'll just say that the Dow's up 5 points as I speak. But now the S&P, putting the S&P up on a weekly basis, and it looks like I've got to go back in and repost those charts, because the bonds are where the S&P should be, and that is not clever. So my IT guy who put this, I'll blame it on him. I will go in and replace those again, and I'll do a proper chart review, if you like, tomorrow. So my apologies for that, and I'll get see if Owen Tracy can correct those for me. All the best.